Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In a new COVID-19 development, UN weather experts said on Wednesday that the pandemic risks disrupting key forecasting services, including early warning alerts around the world. Both the quantity and quality of weather observations and forecasts, as well as atmospheric and climate monitoring, are at stake, according to the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, in Geneva. Here's Lars-Peter Richard, director of WMO's Earth System Branch.
We are concerned about the impact on the ability of our members to deliver their basic weather and climate services. And you may think, why would we care about this? We have bigger things to worry about right now. But even in this situation, there could be situations where all of a sudden you would be critically relying on weather forecasting if a hurricane, a tornado, or some other adverse weather situation breaks out.
Many parts of the global weather monitoring system are automated, such as satellites and many observation points on land. But other monitoring points have already seen a dramatic impact over the last few weeks. This includes readings from airplanes, thanks to plummeting levels of air traffic, particularly in Europe. There has also been a significant decrease in data from developing countries, where many observations are still taken manually, WMO said. In a statement, WMO Secretary General Petteri Talas urged governments to support their national early warning and weather observing capacity despite the COVID-19 crisis. To Niger now, where the UN is helping more than 2,300 migrants across the country who've been left stranded by a COVID-19 lockdown. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, has said that it's worried about the significant numbers of men, women and children still arriving in Niger despite the emergency measures. As of Tuesday, 34 people have tested positive for the new coronavirus in Niger. 3 have died. To prevent virus transmission, the authorities have implemented border closures, curfews and travel bans, along with 2 weeks of quarantine for new arrivals. IOM is providing assistance by hosting migrants in 6 transit centres and 3 temporary transit sites. Those arriving at the border with Algeria are quarantined, and 2 transit houses in Niamey have opened in response to the sudden increase of migrants affected by the border closures. At Assamaka, at Niger's border with Algeria, the agency is helping several hundred migrants as they finalise their 14-day quarantine period. They come from 15 countries of origin, mainly from Niger, Mali and Guinea-Conakry, and include many vulnerable children, pregnant women and injured individuals. Finally, states should step up their measures immediately to protect the 40 million internally displaced people worldwide from the COVID-19 threat, a UN-appointed independent expert said on Wednesday. In her appeal, UN Special Rapporteur Cecilia Jimenez-Damery pointed out that internally displaced persons were at heightened risk of exposure to the virus. They often had limited access to healthcare, water, sanitation, food and adequate housing, she said. They are among the most vulnerable people and should not be forgotten by national authorities in their responses to the pandemic, she said, while calling for governments to ensure that all internally displaced persons should be informed about disease prevention and treatment. Those who require medical treatment for COVID-19 must have access to appropriate health care in a timely manner and without discrimination, she said. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in our continuing coverage of the COVID-19 coronavirus, we speak with writer Doug Henwood.
Doug Henwood is an economist, an observer of the political scene, one of the most intelligent and wittiest people that we have, and with having him on the show, it's a real pleasure.
Prison abolitionist Victor Pate joins us to talk about the plight of prisoners in New York State and around the country.
The virus is going to spread like wildfire through New York State prisons, obviously, if you think about how those men are confined and how those women are confined. The humane thing to do would be to let them out. There's campaigns involved to do that. We're going to talk about how we can help.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Good morning, Michael. How are you doing up north?
I'm 110 miles north of New York City, closer to Albany in the Catskill Mountains. We're broadcasting remotely. Heidi, you're there in Manhattan. How are you, Heidi?
I'm doing well, thank you. You may hear a little construction noise outside my window. That's still continuing. But Michael, I wanted to talk a bit about what's happening on the abortion war front, because the pandemic is igniting new fights. We're seeing red states seeking to close abortion clinics, saying they are non-essential. Do you remember last June we interviewed attorney Elizabeth Smith from the Center for Reproductive Rights?
Yes.
At the time, we saw a rash of bills in 9 states that were limiting abortion in one way or another. And now we're seeing abortion opponents framing the divide in terms of whether the procedure is medically essential. Republican governors in Ohio, Texas, and Mississippi are citing the critical shortage of medical supplies as they try to close abortion clinics. They're saying that orders to close them will help preserve scarce medical gear for hospitals who are facing a surge of coronavirus cases. In New York, however, clinics are actually working to expand access to medication abortion. Planned Parenthood is conducting more assessments over its telehealth platform so that some patients don't have to do anything other than come in to pick up their medication, which is required, as you know, by law. But I think, as in many other aspects of this pandemic, we're going to see working class people and those who don't have the resources to travel to a clinic suffer the most.
They're putting off elective surgery, but there's nothing elective about getting an abortion. Time is of the essence. You have to do it. And their opportunistic attempt to limit people's access, and this is just another aspect of the whole revolting situation that we find ourselves in.
Also, Michael, and I think this is true on several fronts, if there are going to be legal challenges to these laws or measures during the pandemic, any lawsuit challenging state efforts to close clinics could be put on hold indefinitely.
Well, that's what's happened in New York. They've extended the statute of limitations on cases. They've extended the filing dates. Courts are closed. It's, how do you litigate if you can't get in? And that's true not only of the abortion problem, but civil liberties in general. The Attorney General wants Congress to pass a law saying that they can revoke habeas corpus so you can get picked up and never brought before a judge, never charged, just held indefinitely. This whole thing is the shock doctrine in many, many ways.
You know, I just wanted to add that we'll be talking to Victor Pate later in the show about the plight of prisoners. And on the abortion front, Texas is threatening fines of $1,000 or 180 days in jail for any doctor who continues to perform elective abortions. In Mississippi, Governor Tate Reeves has said that they will also take unspecified actions against the state's one remaining abortion clinic if it does not apply with their new measures. And I think to create new crimes during this pandemic, especially when there is no venue available to immediately challenge new measures, is really an insult that they would be locking up doctors trying to do their job.
Heidi, I just wanted to let you know that we're broadcasting here out of my kitchen next to my talking parrot, Charlie Parker. And I want to apologize to the audience in advance if he starts talking. That's what happened to us last time. But otherwise, I'm living up here in splendid isolation. What's it like in Lower Manhattan?
Well, it's pretty quiet. I'm here in the East Village. There are a lot of delivery persons out. And we would, of course, like to extend an enormous message of thanks to those individuals who are going into different apartment buildings, working to get food and supplies to people, as well as, of course, to the frontline health workers. Michael just must be physically and emotionally exhausted but nonetheless are doing their jobs.
And exposed to, I don't want to be overdramatic, but exposed to death every time they show up. Out here in the mountains, I'm scared to go out. The only risk we take is going food shopping. And even then, the food co-op where we go has made a new policy where you call them up, they put your food in a box, you drive over there, you go into the parking lot, and somebody comes out and puts the box of food in your trunk. So we're limiting our shoulder-to-shoulder contact as much as we can. Trump, on the other hand, after Easter, wants people to go back to work. He wants the social distancing that has been fairly effective to stop. We're really facing yet another crisis within a crisis, aren't we?
Yes, but you know, Michael, I think we need to hold out hope in terms of how people are really rising to the occasion. In some states, you have thousands of volunteers helping out in different ways, either to go shopping for people who are homebound, be creative. I saw a TV segment of one teacher who went around dropping off games and gifts for her students 10 or 12 feet from the doors. And even in New York, and I think other places there, have been hearts and other cutouts pasted to the windows to signal to passersby people are sending positive thoughts for those who have to be out and about doing their work.
You know, I lived through 9/11. My apartment house was just across the street from where the Twin Towers were. In fact, if the tower would have fallen over sideways rather than on itself, it would have fallen on me. So I lived through that, and I can tell you that the good side of the American people came out then. People were really kind and helpful to each other, and I think we're seeing that now, too.
I wanted to also mention that I was surfing the web earlier this morning, and in Kansas City, if you put in the words harpist music in Kansas, members of their symphony are making short videos. One's a cellist, and he has a split screen. He's playing actually quartet, where he plays each role, and then his great Dane is in another screen. But people are being really creative and trying to, I think, help others out whatever way they can, and we appreciate that.
I saw the same kind of thing. The Rotterdam Symphony Orchestra in Germany played Ode to Joy, everybody from their own individual home, but then they combined it. It was really uplifting. Anyway, Heidi, I think we've come to the end of our allotted time here with our host chat. I just wanted to mention people can go to lawanddisorder.org. If you want to become a friend of lawanddisorder.org, go to our website, lawanddisorder.org, and then click on the required button, and we'll have your email, and we'll be able to stay in touch with you. So please do that.
Doug Henwood wrote in a Jacobin magazine article last week that, quote, things could get very ugly, but it is also an opportunity to emerge from this crisis a better country. In his article, Henwood articulates a vision, quote, a vision of solidarity and mutual care. He believes that millions of lives depend on that. Doug Henwood's fields of expertise are politics, economics, and finance. He is the publisher of the Left Business Observer and has written four books. His articles have appeared in The Nation, The Los Angeles Times, and The Guardian. He hosts the radio show Behind the News each week on the Pacifica station KPFA in Berkeley.
Doug, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really, really nice to have you on the show. Doug, you wrote in your recent Jacobin magazine piece that, quote, we have the opportunity to emerge from this crisis a better country. What a better country would look like is what I would like to discuss with you this morning. How would you describe the economy you would hope for? What would it be like? Well, I would like for something to be more egalitarian, more secure, more based on solidarity than individual competitiveness. Basically, socialist economy is what I'm dreaming of. But, even on the way there, we could do a lot better than we are now with just more social protections, just a more humane healthcare system, which is screamingly obvious at this point. Better protections for people who are unemployed or otherwise thrown into misfortune. And one, that really fosters solidarity, and one that is living in greater harmony with nature than we're doing right now. I mean, this coronavirus is a sign of a very disrupted relation between humans and nature. The kind of infections we're seeing that cross out of animals into humans, we've always seen those. I mean, those things go way back as far as humanity, but they seem to have gotten more accelerated lately because of so many environmental disruptions. So that's an important thing to think about as we try to recover from this, because with that, with climate change and with increasing disruption of the natural environment, these things are only going to get worse.
Well, the vision that we share for a better country is probably at this point fanciful, but how might that change? What would have to occur for us to actually be able to bring in the kind of humane and decent changes that we would both like to see?
Well, we need a very different politics. Looking at what's been going on just in this presidential campaign, the way the Democratic establishment united to destroy Bernie Sanders and unite behind this utterly pathetic candidate, Biden, who I can't imagine beating Trump. We went from this extremely hopeful moment when Sanders was exciting a lot of people with a different vision of how to do things. Certainly not, my full agenda, but a substantial move in that direction. But now we're just going backwards. Biden represents just trying to return to the status quo, which now seems impossible. And Trump is just, an accelerated descent into a vicious, destructive, necrotic structure. And it's the options right now are not very hopeful. I'm hoping that, that the kind of energy that Sanders unleashed and all, the socialist agitation among young people particularly, will have longer-term effects and push things in a better direction. But, just in the immediate electoral horizon, it's hard to summon up much hope.
What would a socialist USA look like? For starters, let's talk about one of the fundamental transformations that you write about in your article, and that is the banks. Talk about the banks, please. You write about making them into a public utility.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine like an off-the-shelf socialist U.S., but, I think we can look at what it would look like if we were moving in that direction. One of the things we could do is, the banking system has now had repeated crises. If we go back, the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s, that was cured with immense amounts of public expenditure, and we went back to doing the same old, same old. We've had several other financial crises in the 90s. We had, of course, the great financial crisis of 2008, 2009. And every time we went through that, we just had more extravagant efforts by the government to restore the status quo. So banks know that they have this enormous backstop that if they run into trouble, the government will save them. And they have no incentive to be sensible in good times. So they just keep driving us off the road. I think that there needs to be some conditionality on these rescues. People who apply for welfare or unemployment insurance have to jump through all kinds of hoops to satisfy the authorities. But banks can do whatever they pretty much want to. We're also parenthetically seeing bailouts for Boeing and airlines to have undertaken rather enormous stock buyback programs, just enormous waste of money just to boost the value of the stock, which is good for the shareholders and the executives, but not for everyone else. And now they're getting checks from the government to go back to doing the same old thing. So specifically with the banks, I would think if we could just the large banks are now so huge, so concentrated compared to what they were in the past, that nationalizing a couple of them would really transform the financial sector. We often think of the financial sector as kind of superfluous or frivolous or froth on the real effort of production. But in fact, finance has a lot to do with how things are owned and controlled. They are the financial markets are instruments of class formation, ruling class formation. But what I would say is specifically on this issue,
nationalize these banks because they're desperate and they would be in a weak bargaining position. There's not much they could do if the government said this is the way it's going to be, because otherwise they're going to go under. So the thing to do would be, we recreate this banking system just to do really basic stuff, not fund hedge funds and private equity and all this kind of speculative crap they've been doing. But in fact, fund basic financial services, run basic financial services, the kinds of things that we all need, checking accounts, savings accounts, businesses need, real businesses need loans and also checking accounts as well. But that kind of thing, just make them into a boring utility that just do kind of routine efforts of intermediation, but don't really get so deeply involved in trading all kinds of exotic instruments on their own or funding other people who do trade all the sorts of exotic instruments. Just put an end to that crap. Importantly, put what's sometimes called the shadow banking sector out of business. That is hedge funds and private equity. We don't need that stuff. They're either destabilizing or parasitical or both, and we need to put an end to all that. And, that's obviously a fairly dreamy proposition, but we did something like that in the 1930s. And, Franklin Roosevelt was no revolutionary, but he did understand that to save the capitalist system, he had to stabilize it. And, we don't have any figure like that at the present. And one of the reasons that Roosevelt was able to do those things was that there was, starting in the mid-30s, a really serious radical communist movement, and, of course, the example of the Soviet Union. So, capitalism was under severe political competitive stress at that point, and the thing didn't look like it could survive. We're in a different environment now, and there's no figure like Roosevelt on the scene, except, I guess Sanders. But one of the things about Roosevelt that made him possible was that he emerged in the upper class and had kind of insider disdain for the worst of it, and was able to proceed confidently and step on its toes. And we don't have any politicians like that now, sad to say. But, we also need a real movement of people agitating and forcing the issue as well. The banks are, I think, a good place to start, but also, as I say in that piece, the oil and gas industry is another place to start.
I was getting to that, but before I ask you that question, talk about how nationalizing the banks might finance a Green New Deal.
The Green New Deal needs to be financed. I emphasize both parts of that. We need the green part to save the climate, and in the midst of this disease crisis, to rethink human relations with nature. That's an extremely important thing to do right now. But the New Deal part, just the restarting the economy, getting people employed, building an infrastructure. The New Deal built just an enormous infrastructure of parks and municipal buildings and libraries and schools and bridges and airports and all kinds of things that we still use to this day. And we haven't seen anything like it since. We're still, in some sense, living off that. So, everything is just falling apart in this country, socially and physically, morally. Everything seems to be falling apart. So, I think we need both parts of the Green New Deal. We need to fund new ways of generating energy, new ways of getting around, but also a new civilized public environment, better buildings and nicer transportation and even art. The New Deal financed some really great art, and now we're just such Philistines, we don't even think about that. But we can fund that partly through government, traditional taxing and spending kinds of things, but also something like a Reconstruction Finance Corporation, some kind of public bank, perhaps with the assistance of these nationalized banks, that would invest in long-term projects. Take people's savings, this is what banks are supposed to do, take people's savings, transform them into long-lived assets. So, people put their money in their savings account, the banks gather that all together and then invest that somewhere. So instead of investing that in fracking, for example, which is something they've been doing a lot of over the last decade, invest it in clean energy generation or high-speed rail, things that pay an economy-wide return and not human return and not just profit. And that's what a public banking system could do that a private banking system can't.
What about nationalizing the oil and gas section of the economy? Is this a good time to do that?
Well, I think that'd be a great time to do that because the price of oil is down by more than half over the last few months, and the price of Oil company stocks is way, way down. Last I looked, you could nationalize the five biggest oil companies in the U.S. for about $300 billion, or a little over that, which is not very much money by standards even of the U.S. government. So, but the idea would not be to run them on different principles, but just to put them out of business, put an end to carbon as our source of energy. It has to be done quickly, and as long as these giant private companies exist with all that political clout, it's going to be harder to do. So, yeah, nationalize them to extinguish them is my my plan.
Last week, Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor of Texas, who's in his 60s and has six grandchildren, suggested that he and other elderly people would be willing to die to get the economy going again. I thought that this was the most grotesque and morbid example of false consciousness. And I wanted to ask you what your reaction to that was, particularly with Trump now suggesting that he's going to get the economy going after Easter by urging people to stop social distancing and go back to work.
Yeah, I'm in my 60s too, so I took this kind of personally. But, you know, the ghoulishness of this kind of thinking was just fully revealed by that remark. And we've seen other things like that. You know, you see people on Twitter making very explicit remarks along those lines, you know, just sacrifice granny to save things. Even like a liberal like Amanda Marcotte was making a suggestion like that on Twitter the other day. It's like a death cult. I mean, it just reveals that the accumulation of capital under the present system is everything else takes a deep backseat to that. So we're willing to sacrifice people. We're talking about sacrifice human beings. Not in large numbers we're talking about. You know, people in the millions. Sacrifice them just so that production and accumulation of profit can go on. That was just the most appalling and sick thing. And now, Trump, you know, this guy, who knows what he thinks? He doesn't, you know, he just shoots off his mouth. He's not even thinking about necessarily about the consequences of it. But, you know, Patrick was clear about what he was thinking. He was very explicit. Let's kill people to get the accumulation machine going again. And that's just shocking and revolting and a sign of a society really in an advanced state of decay.
The Defense Production Act, which is now in play, allows Trump to command industries to produce necessary items like masks, surgical gowns, ventilators, and so on. The business interests are squawking that this is socialism. They don't want them to start doing this, and the business interests oppose it. Do you think that they're correct to try to prevent it because of what it teaches people?
Well, I think from their point of view, they're correct. What it teaches people is that we could, you know, maybe organize things a little differently, that it might encourage people to think about socialism. It might encourage people to think that the production of things based on what's the most profitable is not a good way to organize our material lives. So, yeah, I can understand their alarm about it, and I can understand Trump's reluctance given the class he emerges from and answers to. But, you know, we fought World War II on that basis. It was very, very successful. We could do it again. And, you know, Trump is making up all these stories about how GM and Ford were already making ventilators, which is completely untrue. And then, of course, they always bring up the example of Venezuela. And Venezuela didn't really nationalize much of anything. The oil company was already nationalized, but there was no program of expropriation of private capital in Venezuela. So, you know, but they always point to that as, like, you know, the thing we're supposed to be scared of. We're going to turn it to Venezuela. Venezuela, which has empty supermarket shelves, right, just like we do now. Yeah, it's just it's ludicrous. I mean, I can understand why they're making this argument from their own personal self-interest, but it makes no sense from the general interest. We really need these things urgently. We have the technical capacity to do it, and we're not doing it because of the structure of our private economy. It's making it impossible, and you know, it's just and I think Trump is rightly afraid that if people see that we can do things differently, they might get a whole bunch of other ideas they don't like. But I'm all for those ideas that Trump and his cronies don't like.
Talk about the effects of neoliberalism on the country's unpreparedness.
Yeah, well, we've seen like constant austerity at all levels of government about anything that's involved with, you know, humane pursuits. So the federal government, but also state and local governments, have been under constant budgetary squeezes. We've seen the erosion of the public health system in the country, the allocation of medical resources, hospital beds, ICUs, and such, based on who can afford to pay for them, not where they're really needed. And we've seen the closure of hospitals in poor neighborhoods in big cities, also hospitals in rural areas, poor rural areas. And this has been all the result of deliberate policy. Governor Andrew Cuomo is getting a lot of attention for, you know, looking like a leader in this present moment. But, you know, he has presided over the loss of 20,000 hospital beds in New York State. Deliberate policy, not just an accident. And here we are with all the public health infrastructure and, you know, so much of the public sector eviscerated, but also just the general erosion of state capacity, the ability to do things. I mean, look at the way the Korean and Chinese and Taiwanese state have been able to respond to this corona crisis rapidly. You know, the Chinese maybe took a little time to get going, but once they did, they did. They showed immense flexibility and skill at responding to this crisis. And we're just standing around, you know, like a bunch of fools on the sidelines and not taking any kind of action until the very last minute. And, you know, many, many people are going to die because of this. So, yeah, the combination of the erosion of the public infrastructure and the erosion of the state capacity, which has been at the core of neoliberalism for 40 years, has left us very vulnerable to a crisis like this. And then also, I think there's also been a change in the public consciousness. We've become the whole idea of solidarity and collectivity has become, you know, fallen into disrepute. And I would hope that this crisis might turn that around some, that people could, some crises can bring out the best and the worst in people. They can bring out the urge to help everyone else, or they can bring out the me first toilet paper hoarding kind of consciousness. I hope that that responding to this crisis will bring back some notion of, you know, collectivity and mutual aid and lead to a reversal of this 40-year individualism binge.
How is the calamity of this dreaded disease a portent of what we might face as the climate crisis worsens?
Well, yeah, we're going to see all kinds of disasters of this sort because climate warming, you know, the changes in precipitation are going to produce crop failures, they're going to produce new diseases, spread of old diseases. This is going to become routine. Like, these kinds of crises will get worse and worse and worse in the coming years. And we obviously are doing a very, very poor job of even acknowledging the problem, much less beginning to respond to it. So this is, you know, this is a terrible crisis in itself, but it's also a taste of what's to come. And I hope that our political system is capable of acknowledging that and doing something about it. I fear that what, you know, our rulers want to do is just try to go back to the status quo ante. That doesn't seem like it's going to be very easy to do, but that's their goal. And no, this, I think, really should lead us to a rethink of how we do absolutely everything. And like I said earlier, we need to rethink the relationships of human to nature. We need to have a much more sustainable relation with the earth that supports us, because right now we're brutalizing it and committing species suicide if we keep up this way.
Doug Henwood, we're unfortunately coming to an end to our allotted time, but before I let you go, can you tell our listeners how people can keep abreast of your work?
Yeah, I have a blog, and I've been posting to it a little more often under this crisis, so you can find, and then I also post links to my radio show, which comes out every week. That's LBO-news, LBO-news.com, and that's where you can find everything related to me.
Say that one more time.
LBO-news.com.
Thanks, Doug. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with us before we say goodbye?
Well, you know, this is just a terrible time, and I didn't even get into this, but, you know, we're, aside from all the economic disruption and the disruption of people's lives and, you know, all the death that's around us, there's an awful lot of psychological damage coming out of this. You know, being isolated, being afraid, being uncertain is going to leave people very, very damaged. So we really need to take care of each other at this moment, because these are really miserable times. And it's like much of the entire human species is going through this right now. It's really unprecedented, the scope of this. And, yeah, I think just take care of your fellow human, and we need to find ways of healing ourselves and our species and our relation to the earth. If you know, this is a terrible crisis, but maybe we can get something good out of it.
Doug Linwood, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We truly appreciate being able to talk with you. Good luck to you and your family. You guys take it easy.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
As the COVID-19 pandemic wreaks a path of devastation around the globe, at extremely high risk are sick and elderly prisoners. Prisons and jails where social distancing is impossible are near-perfect incubators for the coronavirus. Last week, New York City was hit especially hard, with at least 38 persons testing positive at Rikers Island. Another inmate became the first in the country to test positive in a federal facility. In a letter to New York's criminal justice leaders, Board of Correction Interim Chairperson Jacqueline Sherman described a jail system in crisis. She said that 12 Department of Corrections employees, 5 Correctional Health Services employees, and 21 people in custody at Rikers and city jails had tested positive for the virus. And at least another 58 were being monitored in the prison's contagious disease and quarantine units. Across the nation, several large county and municipal jurisdictions have freed thousands of low-risk inmates from jail, including seniors and those in poor health. New York's Mayor Bill de Blasio said last week that New York City may release more than 200 inmates. Joining us to talk about the risks to elderly prisoners is Victor Pate. Victor is the New York statewide organizer for the Halt Solitary Confinement campaign. That stands for Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Isolated Confinement. Victor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you, Heidi, for having me, and I'm honored and humbled that you reach out to me for this time. And it's always good to talk and share and reach out to other human beings, and knowing that, you know, the rest of the world, and especially people that I'm somewhat close to, is doing well. So thank you.
Victor, prior to the pandemic, tell us a bit about your work and what it entailed around solitary confinement.
Yes, so thank you, Heidi. That's a good question. So I am the New York statewide organizer for the Halt Solitary Confinement campaign. And we had a bill pending now in the legislature to reduce the amount of time that people can be held in solitary confinement. We've been working on this bill since 2012, and our bill number in the Senate is 1623, and the Assembly bill number is 2500. So this particular bill is specifically designed and focused around people being held in long-term solitary confinement and under the conditions of which they are being held in long-term solitary confinement. The UN General Assembly has said that no one should be held in any long-term isolated confinement past 15 days, and if they are, then it is considered torture. So our bill is based on the platform of the International Standard Minimum Rules of the Treatment of People in Our Prisons and Jails. So that's the premise of our bill. And as I mentioned, firstly, that number one, what the bill will do will restrict the amount of time that people can be placed in solitary confinement to no more than 15 days, number one. Number two, it will create alternative therapeutic, programmatic, and treatment units for anyone that needs to be separated from the general population for any period of time. But the key factor here is that no longer than 15 days. and after the 15 days, and they will be placed in an alternative treatment unit that involves program therapy, out-of-cell time, interactive time, and opportunity to see, speak with sociologists, psychologists, and anybody in the mental health treatment field. So that's, the short version of our bill. And there are some other components to this particular bill with regards to people that we consider in the exclusionary population, which is considered the vulnerable population, which includes people that are elderly, 55 years old and older, people that have mental or developmental disabilities, people that are classified or diagnosed as LGBTQ population, and of course, juveniles and pregnant women. So we have exclusionary populations that says nobody that falls under any one of those four mentioned categories can be placed in any type of solitary confinement. But more importantly, that they must go to an alternative treatment unit, which includes all of the components that I mentioned previously. You know, basically the short version of our bill and what it will do.
And it's been under consideration for 8 years, you say? That's a long time.
Yeah, that is correct, Heidi. For 8 years, we've been advocating for this bill. Our lead assembly sponsor, Jeffrey and Aubrey, and originally former Senator Bill Perkins, who is now a council member, were our original sponsors, Senate and Assembly, respectively.
We are broadcasting nationally, so we want to make very clear this is New York State.
Right.
But obviously, the issues that we're going to be talking about, and we need to pivot now into the virus, these issues apply across the country.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, Victor, tell our listeners, what are medical conditions generally like in most prisons?
Based upon the last information that I have received, that it is slowly but surely making and working its way throughout the correctional system. What happened immediately after, you know, there was notification that, you know, there was this coronavirus going down? Immediately, they suspended visits in all New York State prisons. And no one was able to receive visits. As a matter of fact, that edict is still in place, and it's supposed to go through April. So no visits are able to allow to come into any of the New York State prisons as it is right now. There's been limited movement in all of the prisons, and for the most part, a lot of the jails are now under restricted movement or either keep lock or either some type of lockdown, allegedly to diminish the opportunity for infection. However, that has not actually worked because you have, from what I understand, there's three New York State prisons where there has been the virus outbreak. I believe it's in Attica Correctional Facility. I believe in Wendy's Correctional Facility. And I also believe in the Sing Sing Correctional Facility, where they have reported cases of coronavirus infections. They have not issued any protective or preventative measures for those that were incarcerated in these particular facilities, other than them being isolated and cut off from any communication from the outside. We've received reports from one of the facilities that there was about maybe 30 to 40 incarcerated persons that were trying to get to the sick call medical treatment, and that they were all turned away for whatever reasons, I don't know. There is no treatment being given to the people that are in these prisons and jails. There is no protective equipment that's being given to the people in these prisons and jails. And I don't know if you know it, Heidi, but the people in the Great Meadows Correctional Facilities were made to create hand sanitizer, which is alcohol-based, which, you know, is contraband inside the correctional facility, for the consumption of the general public outside yet they were denied access to this. We're hearing sporadic reports that now they are issuing some type of alcohol-based hand sanitizer to the people that are in prisons and jails. They are supposedly being given more access to more soap. But on overall, there has been no treatment or medical prevention plan that has been implemented in any of the correctional facilities that we know of to date.
And of course, Victor, when we're talking about older inmates who are at low risk of recidivism, they are among the more vulnerable generally to become very ill or even pass away when they get the virus. Let's talk about what the demands are. Listeners should know that you and I work usually very near one another at the A.J. Musty Institute, part of what we call our prison abolition wing. And the Parole Preparation Project and Release Aging People in Prison work near Victor as well. Now, they've issued a set of demands. And Victor, can you talk about what those demands are? I know the first one deals with releasing prisoners.
Right. Thank you, Heidi. And yes, you know, we all do work in close quarters. Actually, we all share the same little small space, but it's a vibrant space, and I'm glad to even be there, you know, amongst, you know, them and have opportunity to work along with RAP campaign. So they have issued a list of demands. I don't know all of them by heart, but some of them that I do. So amongst the demands that they have, they're asking for clemency, you know, first and foremost, and release for people that are 55 years old and older, and or those who are, I guess you can say, have compromised immune system, because, you know, you age three times faster in prison than any other environment. So you have people that are elderly and older people that have compromised immune system. Of course, you know, there is no real effective health care in these prisons and jails. So when people become elderly and their systems become immune compromised, you know, they are more at risk, you know, for infections, et cetera, et cetera. So with the advent of the coronavirus, they're asking for, you know, release and clemency of people of 55 years old and those of them that are sick and infirm. They're also asking for protective gear, like masks, like everybody else has out here, for people that are incarcerated who are at a greater risk of infection because of the close proximity, and there is no social distancing that even exists in incarceration. So that's totally out of the question. So they're asking for, you know, protective gear for those particular populations, people that are in the prisons and jails. And they're asking for the release of that in prison. Now, what you also, like you say, what you also have because of people being elderly in our prisons and jails with regards to sentencing, you have people who are doing life sentences, life without parole, et cetera, et cetera. So they're asking for those sentences to be commuted and that people who are in those particular categories, that they be released from prisons and jails, all adding to the decarceration of people in our prisons and jails. And it's just so, I guess, sad that, you know, this particular population of people that's incarcerated are five times more likely to become infected more quicker than any of the population that's out here because of the proximity, enclosed environments, lack of adequate ventilation, you know what I'm saying? So it's really sad that they have this captive population, and they actually in a situation of life and death at this particular time. So, you know, it's just sad that we have been writing the governor for the longest. Everybody has doing a coalition-wide sign-on letters asking for the release of the elderly, the sick, and the infirm people that are in our prisons and jails. And it's been no response, bottom line. I haven't seen that one thing in regards from the governor's office or anybody in any correctional authorities responding to what they are going to actually do with regards to releasing elderly, aged, and infirm people from our prisons and jails. or what they're doing to protect them.
Victor, before we get into that, I wanted to note that another way inmates are really exposed is through correctional officers. I read that the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision has said that correctional officers in New York will not be allowed to wear or to bring in their own masks to work. So the general public may not be aware, Victor, of the ways in which inmates are exposed. Has that impacted how many prisoners are in solitary confinement, to the best of your knowledge?
Yeah, so thank you for your question too, Heidi. And yes, it has. It actually has upticked the solitary population as a result of, coronavirus, because, of course, the response from correctional authorities have been, keep locked, separate, isolate, From what we've been hearing coming out of some of the correctional facilities is that when people are showing symptoms, and that without diagnosis, they're taking people out of their units and putting them in what they're now saying is a medical unit. But this particular medical unit that they're allegedly identifying is only being used to separate people from the general population with no medical treatment whatsoever, and they're just keeping them isolated. So they're creating more peep locks and more shoes, even though they say they use the word, separate units, but it's creating peep locks. And a lot of the facilities are now turning into keep lock facilities due to the coronavirus, or the fact that people are exhibiting some sign without proper diagnosis, and the numbers are going up. So you have more people that's restricted of their movement be now, post the coronavirus than it was before. So this is really upticking.
Victor, you use the term keep lock. Can you just define that for our listeners, please?
So keep lock is usually defined anytime you have restricting of the music. I think it's 17 and a half hours of restricted movement, either in cell or out of cell. It is considered keep lock. So when you have, people that, well, in terms of how keep lock is implemented, it's different from a medium facility than it is for a maximum security facility, because in the maximum facility, you have jail cells. And when you're keep locked, that means you're in your cell, okay? That means 23, 24 hours, you're in your cell. You do have some of your property, right? And you do have opportunity to talk to other passersby. But you're in your cell, and you're in the housing or either the lock unit that you're on. In a medium facility, keep lock could be a whole dormitory or a whole unit of people that can't go off of that unit for whatever particular reason, programming or whatever the case may be. They're fed on the unit. They don't go to the mess hall. So the carts come to the unit. The cart comes to the dormitory. The cart comes to your cell, and you don't have free movement. So when you're talking about keep lock, it means restriction of movement, either in a cell or either on a unit.
Victor, I heard Mayor de Blasio in one of his afternoon televised addresses indicate that he was aware of the demands to release prisoners and that was under consideration at the time that we are taping this show. You indicated that you haven't heard anything in response to RAP and other prison groups' demands. Has there been any movement to release people from prison or jails?
Well, jail, yes. From what I understand now, the number of people that have been released, I believe it's 275 people, because they release, and this is all between last week and this week, 75 people were released from Rikers Island last week, and another 200 were released this week. So as far as I know, the count is 275. I haven't heard any releases from any of the state facilities as of today. I was on the phone with one of my other comrades who actually works for the Correctional Association, who is an oversight and monitoring organization for state correctional facilities. And I haven't heard anybody being released from any of the state facilities. But they are now starting to release people from pretrial detainees, let me say, from Rikers Island.
And we should clarify for our listeners that Rikers and other jails on the local level are for prisoners who are serving terms of 12 months or less.
Correct.
And that prisons are more than a year.
Right. That's the differentiation. You got it right.
Victor, has the president chimed in on any plans to release federal prisoners?
I haven't heard it, if he did, as of yet. And I don't know like what the federal advocates groups are actually doing with regard to that, because I haven't seen much posted from any federal advocacy groups. I know we've had a number of calls with statewide advocacy groups, but I don't remember hearing any federal advocacy groups on the phone calls that we've had, and this has been coalition-wide, statewide calls with regards to responses. So I haven't heard anything from the president at all as of yet.
And usually when there are calls for reform of any sort within correctional institutions, the Correctional Officers Union speaks out against that. Has that happened in this case?
Yes. Yeah, just so it's ironic you would ask that too. We had one success so far. 2018, the solitary confinement bill passed in the Assembly. The Senate did not vote on the bill in 2019, but we had that one success and had a one House victory through the Assembly that they passed the bill. So 2019, we had assurances that they were going to pass the bill. And of course, you know, the Correctional Officers Union, New York State Correctional Officers Benevolent Association, affectionately known as NYSCOBA, came out with all of these different comments on, you know, why passing the halt bill will jeopardize the safety and the security of their officers, you know, and they need to have a system of discipline to maintain order and safety in the correctional facility. However, we have never have had the opportunity, and we have invited them to the table so that we could have dialogue with regards to the solitary confinement bill. They have never come to the table. So they are our biggest opponents to this bill being passed. And we believe that because of the amount of influence that the New York State Correctional Officers Union has and connections to Governor Cuomo, because of course they financially contribute to his campaign, as well as some legislators who have prisons and jails in their districts, has been a stumbling block for us in getting this bill passed, especially from the Senate side. So yeah, they are our biggest opponents, you know what I'm saying, amongst everything else. And it's just sad because we do have the majority of votes in both houses, 34 and 79 respectively, Senate and Assembly votes. So we have enough votes to get the bill passed if the leadership brings it to the floor.
Okay, now I just want to clarify, you're speaking about the solitary confinement bill.
That's correct.
And then I was also curious if you've had any experience that the correctional officers, the Benevolent Association, is opposed to releasing inmates for health during the coronavirus pandemic.
I haven't seen anything, so I'm going to say at this particular time, I do not think that there is any opposition to that in the state prisons, because I haven't seen anything that has been put out. I'm not saying that it's not existing, but officially there has been no opposition by them as of yet.
Victor, how can our listeners learn more about this issue?
So there's a few ways that they can learn about the issues. Well, for the Halt Solitary Confinement campaign, our website is www.nyaa, www.ccic.org. And on our website, it tells you about the campaign. It gives you our upcoming actions. And actually now we're working on updating our website because now, of course, everybody's switching to virtual and Zoom meetings. So we all have to become tech savvy now. So anything that we will be doing and any information that we have as far as updates on what's happening with especially when it relates to this bill, the legislature can be found on our website. And, of course, our colleagues with the RAP campaign, you can go to their website, which is rapcampaign.org, and they have a listing of various information and updates with regards to what's going on in our state prisons and state jails with regards to the coronavirus and the people that are being held in state prisons and jails. And they work along with the Parole Prep organization. So any one of those websites people can access with regards to updates and what's going on and what the latest status is with regards to any reports of infections, and that includes staff as well as people that are incarcerated in state facilities.
Victor, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Law and Disorder, and we wish you the best in your important efforts.
And thank you, Heidi, for having me on, and I appreciate the work that you're doing to amplify the work that we all are doing, and hopefully, like I said, we all can connect and link and work together in our respective arenas, but, you know, we'll get through this. Thank you much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. This month on the TaxCast, the climate crisis and tax justice. Coming up later, we're going to talk to Dr. Gail Bradbrook, co-founder of Extinction Rebellion.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency, but the other bit of it we haven't done strongly enough yet is to hold out the vision that change is possible. We know that tax is a really key issue.
We'll speak to Gail later in the programme. But before that, here's a quick news roundup. The coronavirus crisis is exposing all the damage that neoliberal thinking and marketisation of public services have been doing to our lives. And if ever there was a time when governments needed to act urgently in the public interest to implement wealth taxes, take healthcare out of private hands and ensure corporations pay fair taxes, that time is now. I'm not going to dwell on this too long because we're going to talk soon about ways we can reform our economies in the public interest. While some countries have guaranteed to compensate workers for losing wages because of the coronavirus, giving them relief on mortgage, utility bills and other debts, and often not on rent, at the same time, lots of people around the world have no protection, no rights to sick pay. So many people are already living on the edge of survival, even if they're working three jobs. What we're likely to see, I think, are governments giving massive bailouts for supposedly too big to fail multinational companies and banks, while smaller businesses and those who work for them could be left to sink. This could mean complete state capture of governments by what could turn out to be multinational monopolies. But what should happen now is a restructuring of our economies. So universal basic income payments become the new norm. Universal basic services guarantee us a certain level of care. Public services, which should never have been private, are requisitioned, just like Spain's done with its private hospitals. When this nightmare's over, they should be insisting that they stop being parasites, pay fair taxes, and contribute to healthcare worker training and emergency care. More than 37 million US Americans don't have any health insurance. For those who can afford it, the cost has shot up in recent years. And it's not just an extortionate private levy. It's also bad value for money if you compare it to more efficient public health systems elsewhere, even those that governments have been cutting back on. The economist Gabriel Zucman points out that healthcare free at the point of delivery, quote, would lead to the biggest take-home pay increase in a generation for working families. Healthcare worldwide is being undermined by some powerful private interests. This month in the nation of Lesotho, there's a case at the High Court there where private investors are trying to salvage a so-called public-private partnership, which has ended up delivering just one hospital. And that hospital's now swallowing up almost a third of that nation's entire health budget. These so-called public-private partnerships or private finance initiatives, whole thing was an accounting scam, really cooked up by the big four accountancy firms in the UK. These schemes have been draining Britain's National Health Service of vital resources for decades now, and the big four have exported that model around the world. And in Britain, just as the government's closing down tax offices and firing tax office and customs workers who've got decades of experience, ministers now acknowledge that because of Brexit, 50,000 more staff will be needed for all the extra paperwork. The TaxCast was at a demonstration this month outside the British Parliament with tax office workers, members of Parliament and PCS Union. Here's some of those tax justice heroes who are about to lose their jobs.
We're very experienced people across the country and our jobs are valuable. We're the best bargain you'll ever get. The money that we cost compared to the money that we raise for hospitals, for schools, for the infrastructure, for the roads, we're a great bargain.
We really, really need it more than ever now, especially in the light of coronavirus. We need all the taxes we can get to pay for the extra care that people will need.
500 offices being closed, 50,000 staff being lost, and yet you want the biggest budget to spend the most money. Nobody's going to be around to collect it. Stop this programme now. Support your tax staff, pay for us first, make sure we're still here to do the job you want us to do.
Unfortunately, governments around the world are tending to cut back on their tax offices and some are actually privatising them with some disastrous results. But let's talk about the climate crisis. The science is clear now that we have less than a decade to avoid a tipping point of no return that's going to lead to even more disaster and displacement of people than there already is. There's a battle of ideas, and that's now been accelerated by the coronavirus. After this unprecedented situation, we must reform our economies and transition away from fossil fuels. Let's talk to John Christensen now of the Tax Justice Network for his take. Okay, let's talk about fossil fuel subsidies. I mean, how big are they? If you look at different countries, I mean, the EU isn't setting much of a record. Britain has got the biggest fossil fuel subsidies in the whole of the EU. There is some good practice in Germany, Spain and Italy. They're now giving more subsidies to renewable energy than to fossil fuels. But the United States spends more on fossil fuel subsidies than it does on defence, which is quite something, and 10 times what it spends on education. So, you know, there's a long way to go. Now, if we only redirected 10% of subsidies, that alone, just that, could unleash apparently a clean energy kind of revolution.
Yeah, I think you need to look at subsidies in the broader sense of the term, because most people probably just think about subsidies as price support mechanisms or tax rebates or state-funded infrastructure. But these are actually just part of a huge and complex and largely hidden story. Fossil fuels come in many different forms. Now, despite years of pressure to phase them out, some governments still subsidise the prices of petrol and diesel bought at the pump. And in some cases, coal and gas prices are also subsidised to the consumers. And these forms of price subsidies on the, what we call the demand side of the equation, cost an astonishing $400 billion every year.
Worldwide.
Worldwide. Wow. But you need to add to that the cost of subsidies on the supply side of the equation. That's mainly in the form of tax breaks to the big companies, government-funded infrastructure, the building of the roads, the pipelines, the port facilities and so on, and the exploration and production subsidies, which benefit exclusively the fossil fuel production companies. These subsidies aren't as extensive as the price subsidies, but nonetheless, they still cost a whopping $100 billion worldwide every year. So that all adds up to $500 trillion of subsidies in 2018. But that's not even half the story, because when you bring all the related social and environmental costs into the equation, these are the so-called negative externalities, which are generally ignored by economic models, then an entirely different picture emerges. If, as the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, did in 2017, if you include all the health impacts of fossil fuel production and the damage caused by extreme climate events linked to global warming, you know, the floods and the forest fires and the increased incidence of drought and so on, and if you bring all of those costs into the equation, the true cost of subsidies to the fossil fuel sector runs to an astonishing $5.2 trillion every year. Or, get this, that's $10 million every minute of every day of the year.
Wow, that's quite a statistic.
Yeah.
The UN Secretary General quite memorably said, what we're doing, and I'm quoting, what we're doing is using taxpayers' money, which means our money, to boost hurricanes, to spread droughts, to melt glaciers, to bleach corals, in other words, to destroy the world.
That's pretty much summed it up.
And these subsidies are skewing markets horribly, aren't they? And it's ironic because these oil, gas and coal people supposedly believe in free markets, unfettered by the state and full on competition, and yet they're actually getting the biggest bungs of all, aren't they?
Yep. I think the first thing to recognise about this is that the subsidies have been paid out for decades, and they have reinforced the market dominance of the gigantic monopoly providers, the big oil production companies, the giant coal and energy electricity-driven electricity producers. And these producers have been gouging themselves on subsidised markets for decades and have every reason to resist switching to renewables. And in fact, they've used their monopoly market powers to lobby for yet more subsidies and to block potential rival energy sources. So what the subsidies do is to distort the basic supply and demand of the marketplaces across the entire world. And just remember that motor yacht fuel and jet fuels for the private jets, they're largely exempt from fuel duties. So the very wealthiest people are generally the biggest beneficiaries from the subsidies. But subsidies also encourage the production companies and their bankers and their financiers to keep on investing more and more into exploration and production. And it undermines the incentive to develop new renewable energy sources. And that explains why the major oil companies, the Exxons and the Shells and the BP and so on, why these companies, whilst they followed the science of climate change since the 1970s, they have done so little to develop renewables over the course of those decades, because the subsidies just keep them in business as usual. Now, let's be clear about one aspect of the fossil fuel subsidies. These subsidies do not help the poorest people on the planet. People who don't drive cars, who don't have air conditioning or central heating, yet it's the poorest people who are being hit the hardest by the climate crisis. It's the richest 7% of the world's population who are responsible for half of all greenhouse gas emissions. And that gives you a sense of how these subsidies are mainly skewed towards benefiting the richest households.
Yes, and the question we must always ask ourselves is, qui bono? All good economists know who benefits. So who is investing in fossil fuels? Who are they? How do we target them to stop it?
Right, now, until very recently, fossil fuel production companies and the electricity generators who consumed most of their output, they were regarded as blue chip investments. It's only really very recently indeed that some investors have started to pull out of these investments. So almost every class of investor held fossil fuel shares of one sort or another, and of course that applies to most pension funds. Almost all the big banks have been lending to oil and gas production companies, and in many cases, remember this, governments have also been huge investors, and some of the largest oil companies are state-owned. They still are state-owned, so governments are involved as well. Now, banks have been amongst the least responsible of the investors. But trying to persuade bankers and other financiers to divest from fossil fuels has been a torturous experience, mainly because they know that as long as all those subsidies continue to pour into the sector, profitability will remain high, and they won't be left holding what are known as stranded assets. Stranded assets in this context are big oil and gas and coal resources that have been explored and are identified on the reserves of the production companies, but which don't represent profitable investment at current market prices. And with wind and solar energy costs tumbling, more and more coal and oil reserves are falling into this stranded gas unprofitable category. So I think we can reasonably expect to see that more banks, more private equity investors and others will be pulling out because the long-term profits simply don't justify the investment, particularly if the G20 goes ahead with its commitment to phase out the fossil fuel subsidies.
Yeah, and there were some very targeted actions just earlier this month, actually, across the UK. Just under 100 Barclays Bank branches got shut down by people, and they are the worst in Europe. They put in $85 billion into fossil fuels in just a few years between 2016 and 2018. So we do need to target these people. But it's not just the banks, is it? It's the big four pension funds, CEOs directly. There's all kinds of people that seem to slink into the shadows, and they need bringing into the spotlight, don't they?
Yeah, they do need to be brought into the spotlight, and you can find this on the information online. The 100 companies that contribute most to greenhouse gas emissions. There's a site online which identifies not only those companies but also their chief executive officers. That map is available at the Decolonization Atlas. And what I think we are advocating is pressure on those chief execs. Identify them, write to them. At the end of the day, this is a human-generated crisis, and we know who the human beings are who are perpetuating the crisis.
In many ways, the best way is to hit the investors and the whole sort of financial side of the problem that we have is to take away these subsidies in one massive hit that's immediately, almost overnight, going to stop making it a worthwhile investment. That's priority number one, right?
It certainly seems to me that if we reshape the markets simply by withdrawing the fossil fuel subsidies, and I'm talking about that in the roundest thing, which includes making the fossil fuel companies pay for the health costs and the environmental costs, which are currently not reflected in the market price, if that was achievable, then you would see such a rapid shift of investment away from fossil fuels into renewable energy, then I think we could realistically talk about a transition happening, you know, within a much, much shorter time period than governments are currently talking about. They're talking about the transition happening, but, you know, up to the year 2050, I think it's time to get ambitious. Say 2030 needs to be the time horizon. That's the very latest, because really we've only got about 8 years to get this seriously underway, and that will require complete phasing out of all the subsidies and making the fossil fuel industry responsible for the wider social, health and environmental costs that they impose upon this planet.
Okay, and what can we do to make other companies more transparent about their greenhouse gas outputs? Because we don't even have transparency on that.
Yeah, you know, up to now we've been talking about the big fossil fuel companies and the electricity generators, but the vast majority of companies have ignored their own contributions to greenhouse gas emissions, and they haven't accepted that they have a responsibility for reducing and ultimately eliminating their own use of fossil fuels. Now, we've seen some recent initiatives to bring greater transparency to the corporate risk exposure in this area, but by and large, corporate accounting gives little or no information out about particular companies' greenhouse gas emissions. But this could be about to change, because there's a new group, it's called the Corporate Accountability Network. We're talking about our very own Professor Richard Murphy, and I suppose I should disclose that I'm on the board of this new Corporate Accountability Network. Now, what Richard's aiming to achieve is to create a new and mandatory accounting standard which will require businesses to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions under four categories, and that includes emissions that arise from the goods or services which the business sells on downstream to other customers. So it's taking a look upstream at where they source their electricity and all the rest of it, but it's also saying, okay, but what happens about the goods and services which you then sell on, and what greenhouse gas emissions might they be responsible for? What Richard's arguing is that this information needs to be revealed on the company accounts, and then, most importantly, the company must disclose its plans to move to net carbon zero emissions and to reveal the cost of achieving this on its balance sheet. In other words, there's a liability here and there's a risk here, and you must now reveal that.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. This month, the Tax Justice Network released a special series on financing climate justice, which you can find on our website, www.taxjustice.net. You're listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. If you want to make sure you never miss an episode, drop me an email on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll add you to the subscribers list. I'll ping you over an email once a month. Tell me what you think of the show. We're going to talk to Gail Bradbrook now, co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. Gail was on the Tax Justice Network board for quite a while, and that's not surprising because the solutions to the climate crisis we're living through are really inseparable from tax justice and economic reform. Gail, let's kick off with looking at where Extinction Rebellion is right now. Can you give us a kind of snapshot of how you see it?
So we've launched in the autumn of 2018, and we've been named as the number one influencer in the globe on the climate crisis, which is incredible. We've got into 72 countries, got over 700 groups across the world. Our initial goal was to shift the Overton window. People now accept we're in an absolute state of emergency. So I feel really proud of that and our contribution to that. And obviously there are other movements that have been part of that. There's been a whole shift in the consciousness. And I think the fact that we centred our movement on grief and emotion and really feeling these times has been a really important part of that move. Obviously, we've made some mistakes. We've been trying to figure out organising social movement while it's growing under our feet at rapid scale. And we stand on the shoulders of so many other movements and a history of resistance. Extinction Rebellion came out of a network called Rising Up, and actually you can trace its origin back to a conversation, from my perspective at least, with John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. I would say a really pivotal moment as I saw it in the tax justice movement was UK Uncut, and when they occupied things like Starbucks and so on, that really put this agenda into the public consciousness. And I think it's really important that the tax justice movement, because it involves people doing deep research and so on, understand the importance of civil disobedience for change, that you have to have those moments of confrontation. And confrontation doesn't mean violence. It can be done very peacefully and beautifully and respectfully, but it is a way of saying no.
The climate crisis deniers have kind of been pushed back quite a lot now for the moment. Do you think that there's not enough fear about the future somehow?
Well, actually, if you look at some of the data, the majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done. And because Extinction Rebellion doesn't talk about specific policies, and that's for good reason, you know, we say, how could we possibly have all the answers? There's always a debate to be had about, you know, how much is this about renewable energy or carbon taxation or carbon budgeting or going vegan or telling people not to fly, or, you know, there's a whole pile of things. We've opened the space for those conversations. So whenever I meet people working in this field in some way, they say, goodness, you guys have changed the discourse. So we don't have to be all things to all people. Our job is to open the window for conversations and for other people to present ideas. The solutions exist. The problem is the lack of political will. Same in the tax justice movement, right? You guys know how to solve tax dodging. Mm-hmm. You've got it nailed. The issue is a lack of political will, isn't it? How do you get political will? Through civil disobedience. So that's where the focus needs to stay.
So let's talk about the tax justice movement and climate crisis movement. How do they bolster each other? How do they intersect?
I think it's really crucial this year that we make these linkages between the tax justice movement, the wider movement for economic justice, and the climate crisis. We know that tax is a really key issue. For example, you can reprice natural resources, the idea of whether it's carbon taxes or carbon rationing. We know that fossil fuels are subsidised by a horrendous amount. That means that fossil fuels are mispriced through these subsidies, and that's anti-competitive to renewables. Although I would say that renewables should be subsidised because, for obvious reasons, we need to transition to a green energy. We know that tax can be used to redistribute wealth, and we know from the sort of spirit level analysis of inequality that people are more willing and able to tackle the climate and ecological crisis when there's less inequality around. There's a direct correlation that taxation is needed for bringing in revenue for tackling the crisis. So how are we going to pay for free public transport? How are we going to pay farmers to transition to more agroecological solutions? It needs money. That kind of Green New Deal based in ecological and climate justice needs money. And, you know, for folks that are listening to this that maybe more from the climate side of things, I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. It's breathtaking. And I think the only reason people get away with it is that people don't understand it. So, you know, one of the issues is how we share this information so people can get it. I mean, there's lots of kind of complicated jargon in the tax and economics field that put people off, and I think we have to come up with a new narrative. And I think also, you know, part of that is this whole idea around corporate accountability. And, you know, that's part of the tax movement, isn't it, is looking at what the, as Prem Sekar called them, the pinstripe mafia are up to, the big four accountancy firms and the law firms, etc. And I think they need to be a major target this year.
Let's talk about the role of business, because for a long time there's been this conversation, always comes back to the economy versus the planet, growth versus the planet, and, you know, debates about capitalism, anti-capitalism, pro-capitalism. There's so much to unpack there, isn't there?
I think it's an utterly crucial issue, and we have to get this right this year, absolutely. And the first thing I would say is, let's not jump into ideological camps. I'm anti this, I'm pro that. Yeah. All of these words have got baked in ideas, and different people mean different things by them. The minute you state yourself as an anti-capitalist, you're in a camp and other people think you're against them. It's completely arguable that we haven't even got capitalism, because half of all world trade goes through secrecy jurisdictions, and my understanding of capitalism is you're supposed to have transparency of markets.
We've got subsidising of basically monopolies as well through giving these enormous tax breaks, so that's not even proper competition.
Exactly, and I think that there isn't one consensus. I know, talk about the Washington consensus around neoliberalism, but there isn't one consensus about what a good economic system looks like. And so I think that's where we need to have the conversation. And I think a really good starting point for it is, what is the intention of an economic system? And it should have a moral intention, right? And interesting, Milton Friedman, I'll be paraphrasing him, says something along the lines of, because the market-based system will ensure that no power is concentrated, the kind of harm that can be done by concentrated power will not be done. So Milton Friedman wants a system whereby there's no power concentrated and no harm done. And Mrs. Thatcher actually said something similar. When we know that eight people have got the same wealth as half of the world's population, right? And we know there's all this rigging and corruption, and I don't think, you know, outside the tax justice movement, people know half of what's going off, you know, when you know what's happening in a secrecy jurisdiction. So let's start with a discussion about what the economy is actually for. We are undoubtedly killing life on Earth. Goodness me, the debate needs to be, what are we doing wrong? And we've heard the elites at Davos talking about planting a trillion trees. Well, great, yes. And where's the actual plan? Is that a distraction, that we'll be planting trees while they're buying up real estate in the mountains, you know? Where's the actual plan that we all get through this? Or are we just going to throw Africa to the dogs? You know, that's what it feels to me this is about, is shoring up some people's safety. The UN have talked about the collapse of civilization. The Committee on Climate Change have said that we can't manage 4 degrees of warming, we won't be able to adapt to it. So, and that's the pathway we're on. This system's finished. So the conversation should be, let's get real. This is finished. It's going to kill itself off anyway. It's killing us anyway. So what are we going to do instead? And let's rewire humanity. Extinction Rebellion at the minute are working on a plan to push that agenda forward.
Right. I want to ask you about what is the role of business? And, you know, we can have growth that is a desirable kind of growth. Doesn't have to be all about GDP.
Yeah, I think if we start to have a narrative about what the economic system is like right now, the one that we're working on is to use cancer as an analogy. So a healthy body, bits of it will grow and replenish, and bits of it will be more like steady state, you know, bodies grow up and things like that. So some growth is good, but growth for the sake of growth is the logic of the cancerous tumour. And at the minute, you can think of the investment community as being the heart that pumps resources around the system. It's perfectly willing to pump them through the arteries of the finance system into a cancer. That needs to stop. You need an immune system to tackle diseases, you know, like cancer, and the immune system normally deals with cancer. However, when it goes wrong, when the regulatory system, the legal system that we're sitting under is, you know, offshore, if you don't like the regulations here, let's have law avoidance and go offshore and get a different form of law, your actual immune system is attacking your body. So we've got to deal with that. In Extinction Rebellion, we're very much in support of the Stop Ecocide campaign, that we need to bring in the fifth crime against peace at the Rome Statute level alongside the crimes of genocide, war crimes and so on. And the crime of ecocide would criminalise mass damage and destruction of the environment and would put the onus on us all to repair the harm being done through this crisis. And I think business leaders as a constituency need to start pointing out some of the systemic issues that mean that they are trapped in unhelpful behaviours. You know, one of the issues is that we generally, in terms of the environment, only have civil laws to protect us. And if you even get caught, and if you even get found guilty, and if you even get fined, you know, it's a cost of doing business. You'll think 10 times about doing mass damage and destruction if you're going to be criminalised. So we need criminal law in that space. I believe, you might be able to tell me, Naomi, but that when they get these fines, sometimes they write them off so they get into the tax bill, don't they? I mean, you know.
They're like parking tickets. You know, if you're rich enough, then you can park anywhere you like.
Yeah, yeah. And we cannot afford that. Not things like tar sands and fracking. And we know that there's a tipping point for the climate into a different state from which you cannot reverse. And so what cognitive dissonance is going on that people think they can get away with that?
I want to just go back to the idea about growth and the fact that we can have growth, but we can have growth in social terms, like social care, growth in social care, growth in education.
What I thought was a really great concept, private restraint and public luxury. So I don't need a car if we've got free public transport, and you know, obviously you have to have different transport forms depending on which communities you're in. There are solutions that exist, and I think that it's moving into that space of public luxury, of universal basic services. That's the kind of thing that we need to be aiming for. But obviously that requires governments to have money to spend and deploy, and that means we have to have a functional tax system, which we don't have at the minute.
Yeah, it's really interesting that the real radicals are never highlighted as radicals, right? So we've got people running governments who are doing extreme things, extremist things, which are very damaging for people, for the environment and all the rest of it. And yet you get Extinction Rebellion was put on a terrorism organisation watch list by the police. How do you react to that?
Utterly unsurprised. That's what's been happening to activists for many years. Yeah. But you're quite right. Where are the real extremists here? In years to come, we'll look at people like Bolsonaro and Trump and Putin and the Australian Prime Minister, etc., as criminals that pushed genocide. Because we're on a trajectory to 4 degrees of warming, and Jonas Rockström of the Potsdam Institute says about half the world will die, according to him. Billions and billions of people, that's genocidal policies that are being pushed. That's where the extremism lies. When they put us on those kinds of lists, everybody's like outraged, and to an extent it's quite useful to the movement, because it's like, yeah, this is what the state's force really looks like.
What are Extinction Rebellion's plans for this year?
So at the time of recording, Naomi, we're in a strategic process, so what I'm going to say is not nailed down, and so it's more my take on things. There needs to be a deep focus on the role of the economy in this crisis, and an understanding of that, and a rewiring of the system, and also on the role of certain bits of the media that are acting against the climate and ecological crisis with how they're messaging. In terms of focusing on the economic system, what I'm hoping will bring forward this year is a focus on debt refusal. You know, debt is something that people hold with shame and struggle with, and the debt-based economy fuels the cancerous type growth that's unhealthy. We're talking about something like XR Money Rebellion, where we would be taking actions to banks and to the big four accounting firms and all that type of stuff. And alongside of that, we might refuse debts. Now, some people can do debt disputing, which is not illegal, but it's a way of saying, is this debt really legitimate? And some of us may take on debts or may already have debts, and we say we're not paying it back to the system. Really force this conversation about the economic system that we have. My great desire for this year is that we announce our own, if the government won't do it, our own international citizens assembly. The way that would look is you have a, like what you call a multi-stakeholder panel, which would have economists on, and you use convergent facilitation to look at what people feel is important in a market-based economy, what businesses need, and what's not working, and what's, you know, what could be upcycled, if you like, from this system. And you present that to experts' opinions presented to this panel, representative panel of citizens, and they make a decision. If when people in the elites and business world start to call for that, then we'll know that things have shifted.
Right. You were talking about sometimes you speak with bankers and all sorts of people, which is great, and they're getting hassled by their kids. And it's just very interesting, the younger generation are managing to connect with them.
Well, literally around their own dining table, right? So, yeah, I've been told in a number of ways that they're getting hassled from their kids. So do not underestimate your power. You have got serious power to influence the people in your own families and far wider, by the way. And that's really important, because all of us in this system that we live in are running some form of cognitive dissonance. We care deeply about the future and our children, and yet we're sitting in some form of complacency, some form of denial, some form of idea that, well, we can just do something from within our box and things will get better. Well, sometimes the box is the problem, isn't it? And some people are even trying to make sure the box is nice and solid and can't get changed. I think it's quite correct for the young people to be saying this is about our future. So we've been willing in the West to let this crisis run and for the problems to be felt by people who have done the least to cause the crisis. The fact that we have had so much injustice in that way is now coming home as an intergenerational injustice. It's not for everybody to join us on the streets and get arrested, but if it's for you, join us on the streets, because another emotion to feel is the emotion of being in your true power.
You've been listening to Gail Bradbrook of Extinction Rebellion on the TaxCast. For all those listening who are in lockdown because of the coronavirus, we're thinking of you. Stay safe. Let's look after our elders. And let's make this unprecedented crisis the time for reform in the public interest. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.